First of all, I just want to say thanks to Roshi. Are you here? Oh, there you are. And to Mokwin Sansoy for their talks. It was very, very helpful and very illuminating. And I thought about the controller and the one bright pearl and the master of Rengyo, or the master of Vulture Peak. Would have made a good title for a talk, I thought, the characters, but anyway, I didn't call it that. I've called this talk Stopping the War, and I'm going to draw fairly freely on a book by Jack Kornfield, which you're probably familiar with, which is A Path with Heart. It's a few years old now, but still a good read and a useful guide. The classic guide through the perils and promises of spiritual life is the subtitle, which works for me. The perils and promises of the spiritual life. Oh yeah, I also just wanted to mention this is a kotsu, a teacher's stick for emphasizing points. So I suppose at the back of the day, it'd be the sort of thing that a teacher would throw at you if they felt you weren't listening properly. But I wanted to mention it particularly because Steph made this last year when I received Shiho. So appreciate it. Yeah, stopping the war. I suppose the obvious war that comes to mind, which is fair to say, I would think, has been a shock to all of us, you know, and when I say all of us, I mean the world, but specifically Europe, the war in Ukraine. And the element of shock, I suppose shock, a war is always a shock, particularly to the people who are in the front line of it, and civilians, it's always a shock. But I guess the added shock of this one was that somehow we assumed in Europe that we'd seen the back of this sort of war, this sort of territorial war, which, yeah, seemed to belong to the last century, really. An invasion. I think we can all readily agree that this, even Mr. Putin himself, has agreed that this is no longer a special operation. This is a war. This is all-out war. and it seems set to continue for a long time, unfortunately, probably for years. But if you follow the news, whether you follow it on social media or on the main channel news, the thing that strikes me about it is that the reporting also seems like previous wars of this nature. You know, there's a lot of focus on territorial gains, territorial loss, the nature of the weapons being used, the civilian casualties, the promises from the West, the threats from the East, and a country that effectively stuck in between two superpowers, basically nuclear powers. With their own agendas that have always been there for at least the last 50 or 60 years. A lot of flag waving going on as well. The other feature about it is that there's a lot of political Trump thumping and flag waving one way or the other. And so the thing that seems to be missing in all of it is the peace brokers, the peacemakers. It's not to say that they aren't there, or they aren't active in some way, in some forums, maybe in the United Nations. But my point is that then, in terms of reporting, peacemakers are generally not very high profile. The high profile is the combatants, the politicians, and the civilian casualties, quite rightly. You know, but the actual process of peace or establishing peace, and we might say, well, how could you establish peace with somebody like Putin, The guy's a madman, you know. He's impossible to deal with. He's not interested in peace. Well, yeah, that's certainly a point of view, and maybe that may be radically right. But the, in parallel, the question of who's working towards peace here, it certainly isn't Putin. And whether it's the West, we are the West, is unclear. Certainly the winners of all of this have been, great winners have been, if you've got shares in an arms manufacturer, you'll be having a good time, because that's the place where it's all getting spent, the money's getting spent. But anyway, we can say with war that the thing that characterises it is it's usually violent, it endures over a long time, and it has many sorts of candidates. We could talk about the war, you know, not just the war of this nature in Ukraine, but the war against disease, against COVID, against cancer, the war on drugs, the war in the government between the left and right. War is fairly prevalent. But also there is another war that we're all engaged in to a greater or lesser degree throughout the course of our lives. And that, what would that war be?
Our mind.
Sorry, can you?
Our mind, war within our mind.
Yeah. Yeah, the war within our minds. Yeah, could I just ask you, sorry, could I just ask you to say, against what?
I don't know, I didn't think that far.
No, we're not. against what? But the war in our minds, I mean, we might say, against ourselves, against this life. Anybody else? Thank you for that. Anybody else?
Sorry. The war against reality.
Yes. Yes. The war we hold against what, how things are. You know. And we were mentioning Ken Jones earlier with his book of poetry, book of haiku. And Ken was always... I think, as I said earlier, Ken was, a Zen teacher, taught here many times along with Roshi. And a very loved character. He had his own way of doing things, but one of the things he was always fond of quoting was Hubert Benoit, who's a French psychotherapist, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this phrase, you know. He said something to the effect that the root of a lot of our psychological and emotional problems lie in the fact that we're waging an unwinnable lawsuit against reality. It's a great phrase. I mean, it's worth repeating and repeating. Mm-hmm. We're engaged in an unwinnable lawsuit against reality. I particularly like the fact, the use of the words lawsuit, because it sort of suggests a sense of injustice, doesn't it? A sense of why me? Why now, you know? Why isn't this happening to some of the bad people, you know? The unwinnable lawsuit, a sense of injustice, you know. It shouldn't be me, it shouldn't be now. Jack Cornfield, I borrow fairly freely from that book, says, the roots of war lie in ignorance and fear of the other, whatever the other may be. It lies in a lack of insight into the nature of conflict, the nature of this conflict, and the nature of the enemy. So in this example, I mean, okay, we could talk about more about wars in the traditional sense, but in this example, it's the war within ourselves. So the roots of war lie in ignorance and fear of the other. But the roots of peace lie in understanding ourselves, in understanding our experience. So in our personal battles, whether they're daily battles or an ongoing war, we engage in battles for success, recognition, money, love, self-esteem. We may be threatened by the shocks of life, the fact that it's fleeting, unpredictable, it changes all the time. Everything changes all the time. There's nowhere where we can stand for very long. I like the imagery described by Dogen in the Genjo Koan, where he says, imagine you're on a boat and you're sailing at sea and you're passing a shoreline. And at first you think the shoreline, and imagine a shoreline, like on one of those fishing trips that you go on on a holiday, and you see people running and flying kites and cycling, and there's lots of activity and it's all moving out there. But what he says is, you may think it's the rest of the world is moving until you look at the water, until you look it down and realize where you are. And you see that it's all in movement. Everything is in movement. There is ultimately nowhere you can stand for long without experiencing that. So we may be threatened by lots of things in life. The inevitable changes, the loss of loved ones, disappointments, the insecurity of old age and death. And we might develop effective or ineffective defense strategies. Maybe things like become more busy, get a longer to-do list. I must be important because I've got all these things to do. More knowledge, money, more fitness, physical or spiritual, more allies, more friends. These are all sort of reasonable defense strategies. To do what? Well, in pursuit of a better future, down the line somewhere. I'm doing all this in order to create a better future for myself, for my, families, friends, the world. Somewhere off there. But just a quick quotation from this book, Thich Nhat Hanh, The Other Shore. We actually use this as one of the references when the weekend that Shinro and I did on the commentaries on the Heart Sutra. And Shinro used Red Pine and I used Thich Nhat Hanh. And there's just a short paragraph at the end of it in which he says, in relation to that, our defense strategies and how we approach them. He says that in Buddhist meditation, we do not struggle for the kind of enlightenment that will happen 5 or 10 years from now. And I've just added here, we don't even struggle for some imagined bright future free from pain and insecurity. We practice so that each moment of our life becomes real life. When we meditate, we sit just for sitting. We don't sit for something else. If we sit for 20 minutes, these 20 minutes should bring us joy and life. I don't know if that's what you're experiencing all this week. No.
He left out tiredly.
Yeah. Well, that's what Thich Nhat Hanh has to say, anyway. We should be experiencing joy and life. If we practice walking meditation, we walk just for walking, not to arrive anywhere. We have to be alive with each step. And if we are, each step brings real life back to us. Each breath, each step, is a positive contribution to peace, a necessary step in the direction of peace for the world. In the light of interbeing, and this is an important part of his commentary here, where he talks a lot about emptiness, shunyata, and into being. In the light of into being, peace and happiness in your daily life means peace and happiness in the world. So in the light of into being, everything is conditioned by everything else. There is no separation. So peace and happiness in your daily life and in your practice actually means peace and happiness in the world. It may be a lot to swallow, that. But he's saying, well, that's the teaching. So, I wanted to ask you something about peace. Who have been the peacemakers in your life? Who have been, no names, we don't protect the innocent, we don't want any names particularly, but unless you want to. But what I mean by this is, who or what has provided over the course of your life, at maybe at different times, a refuge, a place of safety, a place of peace for you? Who or what has been a refuge, what's provided a refuge?
Stanwater Sangha. Yes, absolutely, beyond question.
That's a good start. You're sitting right next to the right man there.
Actually, no, in all seriousness, it has, and that shouldn't be underestimated. I think we are really blessed to have our Sangha, and I really mean that.
Thank you, Tim.
Sometimes in certain situation when you feel that war raging, sometimes clarity and understanding of the situation brings peace.
Understanding.
So
we're talking about wars at different levels, nationally, personally, and sure, understanding, it is said, brings or clarity.
Yes.
What is it that we might understand there? What's the understanding that we may gain? Say in relation to a war like the war in Ukraine, what is the understanding that we might gain?
Understanding that the other side is suffering as well.
Yeah.
From all sorts of action from the past. That, yeah. Maybe they have a different view on how life should be lived. And these two collide and, yeah.
Yeah, yes. So an understanding that the other.
Yes.
Whether the other is Russia, I'd yes. say, or whether the other is my own internal conflicts, my fears, my doubts,
yes.
whether it's that, some sort of understanding of how it arises seems to be a condition of...
For peace.
For peace.
Yes.
Yeah.
At least here.
Yeah. We can't force peace onto anyone. But understanding, achieving some understanding and clarity may be a starting point for us making peace with the other. Yeah.
Thank you. For me, I think very often, particularly with big wars like Ukraine, climate change, and also things closer to me, I think what makes me feel threatened is I feel helpless. I can't. I can't. What keeps the war going for me. I don't know what I can do, and I always think I don't do enough. So for me, the place of refuge, I think, is really understanding what my own role is. Who am I in this situation, and how can I be that person to the best I can?
Yeah. And how does that work out generally?
It comes and goes.
It comes and goes.
It comes and goes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think sitting helps.
You think sitting helps?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Who else thinks sitting helps? Seems you've got a lot of agreement there. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Gordon.
I have a big problem with this analogy with Ukraine, that kind of wars, and the other wars we're fighting in our daily lives. I don't know what you Brits would have said if there was a lack of peacemakers when you were fighting the war against Hitler.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I get really upset about this. It's good in sort of in a symbolic way you can talk about it, but for me, a feeling of what I could do to feel at peace, because I agree with you, I can't do anything, is to send money so they can buy more weapons. I can send money so they can support the Ukrainians flight for food. You know, I have a problem. I have a big problem with this kind of putting things on in the same.
The analogy. I know,
but it's. I've heard this kind of analogy before, and sometimes the analogy becomes like a criticism of that there are some wars that you have to fight in a terrible way, because that's life, and it's not solved by us sitting with the sangha. It helps me.
Yeah.
The sangha is really something important for me.
Yeah.
But it helps me support this incredible, terrible thing that is going on.
Yeah.
And please let us invite Putin to this place. We'll be fine. Do you think he will come? I'm not sure. But
I'm pretty sure.
That's okay.
I'm pretty sure. He won't come. He won't come. It's not just Putin, is it? It's not just Putin. There's a whole raft of people who will not come to the table.
I know.
And many of them are in America, and many of them are here.
That's my problem, that you sort of, you put on an equal level. I know this kind of discussion, because it's always present, that this guy is bad, or they are as bad as, you know, but there's so much complexity in this kind of discussion that I have a big problem with.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it.
Sure,
Welcome your point.
Okay,
I do.
Thank you.
And even as I was writing and preparing this talk, I thought, yeah, there is that rider constantly. We're not in a war. We're not being bombed daily.
But you were.
We were. And most people have experienced. Some sort of majority of the people of the world have experienced poverty and war in this sense. Well, I just wondered if it was more sort of, not acceptable, I see where you're coming from, but useful to think in terms of, rather than war, conflict, because conflict, you understand where we're coming from.
You know, I don't have a problem with the discussion in general. I have a problem with when you're sort of starting to discuss this concrete situation, war.
The nature of conflict.
Otherwise, I'm all with you.
Okay. Okay.
But I feel it's
given that rider,
wrong. It's just that I needed to say this.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes, and thanks. And we can say, let's say clearly, that the nature of what we're engaged in sitting, the conflict that we might be opening ourselves to, is not a visceral blood and guts war. And yet it is.
Sure.
for some people it really is.
Sure.
You know, because what we open ourselves up to in terms of, you know, creating a refuge where we can be peaceful and accepting, we open ourselves up to not just what is here and now, you know, being present to what is here and now. It's a nice sunny day and we're all gathered here on day four and we're doing okay, you know. But we're opening ourselves up to the cellar door, aren't we? We're opening ourselves up to stuff that we might have been carrying around for years, which we haven't fully explored. To trauma, for example. So some of us, for sure, are still living with traumatic events. Maybe not physical injury, but mental injury, emotional injury. And emotional injuries that they keep cropping up and keep sort of having a say in the game of how we play this.
Fine, thank you, John.
Let's just stick with this for a little while.
I agree with Thomas that in the real world we don't want, well, I don't think we want peace any cross, but then the big difference with inside my head and that wall is that both sides of me, and I'm the one getting hurt, and I'm the one losing. And so it should be peace at any cost.
It should be what?
Inside my head, it should be peace at any cost, because it's only me who's losing and it's only me who's losing up.
Yeah.
Another thing that came up is the other thing you have in real world wars is lying about the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I do that inside my own head, and I think we all do that. I think I'm battling laziness and actually I'm battling exhaustion. And I think I'm battling I'm evil when actually I'm battling I don't like giving up control.
Yeah.
And I think I'm battling rage and being horrible to people, and I'm just battling being a bit annoyed. And that's part of, like you said, understand where it comes from, understand what it's about.
Yeah.
And then there can be peace, because there's only me who's losing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing we've always got to be careful when we use that phrase, in reality. In reality, usually translates, when I hear it, I used to work in the health service, and if in reality usually came from finance people who were going to tell you that there was no money. You know, the surprise, surprise, Sherlock, you know. sorry, I don't mean to be disparaging about that, but the reality is my reality, you know. In my reality, this is how it is for me. It might be different for you, might be different for each one of us. But it's something we've got to come to terms with. Is my reality may be a very high level of, you know, painful conflict or trauma over years and years. In that sense, in the sense of a conflict that lasts over years, it has the makings of war, you know, a war within ourselves, a war with ourselves or with our life. Thanks, Anna. Thank you. Hang on. Talking to you.
I think for me, something we don't talk very much about in Zen is, you know, we're built out of love. And we now know actually that is not just a kind of romantic view. We know that. Was it here someone mentioning the orphans in Romania, that one, if you don't experience good enough parenting at a certain stage of your life, actually your structure of your body is different and cannot recover those things that we learn when we have a good enough father or mother who loves us. And so in my life I've been, you know, the things that have led me towards peace within myself have been the degree to which I've been loved and being able to love back. And it seems to me that you're talking about the big mind, that, you know, has something very important to say about love and this journey. Yeah. And our humble kind of ordinary human existence is sort of built around this learning to love others and love ourselves.
Would you say that, I mean, that's all important, stuff in relation to, you know, the development of children, the development of our emotions. Just going back to what I was saying about refuge. Because I think for many of us, thankfully, childhood was a refuge. You know, a reasonably happy place. Not for all of us. Not for all of us by long chalk. But it was a refuge. I mean, sorry to do the straw poll, but it is useful. How many would you folks would say, yeah, generally, on balance, looking back, I would say my childhood was a peaceful refuge. Yeah.
Some of us. Four and a half.
Yeah. We're all different. We're all different, you know. And this was stuff that was beyond our control. I mean, other than being born and eating and what have you, a lot of this stuff is beyond our control. When I look at, you have a number of grandchildren, Clive, and I look at my grandchildren and I think how beautiful they are, but how vulnerable as well they are at that early age. You know, how vulnerable we all are. By the time we get to be adults, we you know, for better or worse, we've been through an experience already, which may have strengthened us, may have given us a positive experience of life, or it might have damaged us. It might have damaged us. Just going to say.
John.
Yes.
Sorry. Are you still asking questions? Or
yeah.
Okay. So I want
to say
something.
I'll come by.
Thank you. I really sympathise with what Thomas was saying.
Yeah.
I really, really, really understand. And certainly there's parts of me that would no doubt fight in certain circumstances. I wouldn't be a peacenik, was that what we used to be called, a peacenik?
I can't imagine.
I wouldn't be called. But what occurred to me when Tom, is just how privileged we are to have this opportunity. Because the people who are living in Ukraine, or many people around the world, simply don't have the opportunity to sit and look at their stuff and find peace. Mm. It's just a question of getting bread on the table or surviving.
Surviving the night.
It reminds me very much of, you know, the end of the day, when do not waste your time by night or day. We really are very lucky, all of us, to have this opportunity. And on a lighter note, about peace.
Yes.
I find most peace about a busy day, and I remember to put the electric blanket on. I get into bed, and I've got a cup of hot tea and a cigarette. Oh, it's bliss. That's peace.
Well, thank you. Can I just say, the reason I'm laughing is it's the very first image that came to mind was, well, peace is being able to sleep beyond 5:25. Yeah, on a lighter note. But thank you. Thanks. Yeah. It's such an important point, and it's something I suppose we'd come to in the roundup, that we have an opportunity, you know. Whether it's sending, I mean, I do the same. I don't want to get out there campaigning, but I'll send my money, you know, to support causes. But the just going back to that point about childhood, about you know, development, etc. One of the things in psychology, in child psychology, over the years is going back to Piaget, for example. Those of you that remember Piaget, who got taught about it, you know, there was this idea of critical periods. If it didn't happen during those periods, during those years, it wasn't going to happen at all. That was rubbished years and years ago, you know, because of all the exceptions there were to kids who had experienced trauma, you know, disability, etc., who had come through, you know, you might say the exceptions to the rule. But so I think we've just got to be careful with the idea of, you know, your being is set from a certain age. But to be open to the fact that, yes, I had a good childhood, but I'm privileged.
Can I just add a rider to what you're saying? I think those of you who know Gabamate, the Canadian doctor and writer on trauma, he points out very, and I think it's very important, that trauma isn't what happens to you. It's the sense you make of it.
Yeah.
And then in a way, what you could say we're all here, something to do with that in one way or another.
Yeah.
Making sense. Appealing that, whatever.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I'm just going to, because it's the relevant point for me to read this from Jack Cornfield. It's an account of a student, a Buddhist student, who was a combat veteran, and it sort of touches on the nature of trauma for him. So this is a Buddhist student. It tells a story about a meditation retreat where he experienced for the first time the terrible atrocities he witnessed as a soldier. So the student says, "It had been 8 years since my return from the war when I attended my first meditation retreat. At least twice a week for all those years, I sustained the same recurring nightmares common to many combat veterans. Dreaming that I was back there facing the same dangers, witnessing the same incalculable suffering, waking suddenly alert, sweating, scared. At the retreat, the nightmares did not occur during sleep. They occurred during the day. They filled the mind's eye during the day at sittings, during walking meditation, at meal times. Horrific wartime flashbacks were superimposed over a quiet redwood grove at the retreat center. Sleepy students in the dormitory became body parts strewn across a makeshift morgue in the demilitarized zone. What I gradually came to see was that as I relived these memories as a 30-year-old spiritual seeker, I was also enduring for the first time the full emotional impact of experiences that as a 22-year-old medic, I simply was unprepared to withstand. I began to realize that my mind was gradually yielding up memories so terrifying and life-denying that I had ceased to be consciously aware that I was still carrying them around. I was, in short, beginning to undergo a profound catharsis by openly facing that which I most feared and therefore most strongly suppressed." So that notion that, you know, we hear many sort of stories of people who endured similar experiences in combat and you know, illness and ill health and disability, etc. And emotional trauma as well. So it's interesting that in this instance, this account, he's saying that I'd been carrying these things around for years.
That's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Suppress them.
That's heartbreaking, isn't it?
Yeah. It was his reality. So I think when, you know, when we talk about being present, about, you know, what can we do? What can we do in the face of conflict or war? We can be fully present to our own conflicts, to our own, say, rather than trauma, emotional memories, although trauma probably says it better. When we start to open ourselves up to those, it's not an easy ride. Creating peace is not an easy ride. It's not a soft option. Although it's often painted as such, you know. My initial point was that you don't really see a lot about it in mainstream media. We don't get a lot of reports about what actions are being taken, what movements are being taken towards peace. Because it's not reported. It's not sexy. You know, look at how many cruise missiles the Russians have sent over and how many have been shot down. It's much more sort of accessible.
John?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt again. In the first month of the war, there was a lot of reports on Macron calling Putin, and whoever called Putin, there were peace talks, and then they died out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're reporting that out or if the actual peacemaking process died out.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I think the peacemaking process died out.
Right, You're right. Yeah, I can see where.
There was a.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
I'm not sure. I don't know.
You what was it?
Can I say just one thing? In Jokoji, many hundred years ago, I was sitting next to Jiakwen Batura. Exactly that.
But you were sitting next to.
I was sitting next to Vietnam veteran.
Yeah.
Right here.
Right.
And after 3 days, he had to leave, but because he was like, I don't know. I have never seen a tense person like him. So that's the way it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
He couldn't stand it.
Thanks, Thomas.
I hope he came back to.
Yes.
This person.
Yeah. Mark.
Was the original question you asked how we find peace?
This is great. This is great. But because it's in the sense of who or what has created peace in your life? Who has created a refuge for you at different times?
Only because I was thinking, I've got two friends that have done that a lot for me, and reminded me a bit of a talk we had the other day. They're a complete wrecking crew. Yeah. Everything I say, they take the piss, they give me a load of jib. Mm-hmm. I go home, I feel so happy, because they've deconstructed all the sort of bullshit that I've been going on about, and I kind of do it to them.
Yeah.
And it's good fun.
Yeah. Moving on.
One other point as well. This is quite important to me, so I think it's important I say it. I've got two boys, both of those were adopted, both of those had a lot of trauma, both of those are very, very happy human beings.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I think we've got to be careful how we think about things.
Yes, of course. Yeah, we have to be true to ourselves as well, true to our experiences. Mm. And in being open to it, I think the important thing for me is when we talk about being present and being open to our emotions, we should know that it may be okay. It may be okay over time.
That one pushes my emotion because it's kind of my job to say it. So I always get a little push when I hear anything like that.
Yeah.
But I'm aware that's kind of my energy comes up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I just ask, how do we change these sort of dominant narratives, whether on a kind of personal level or on an international level in terms of the reporting and not just about this war, but the wars that aren't reported, the wars that are going on, personal opinion, in this country on people who are much poorer, and so on and so forth. How do we challenge those narratives?
At one level, I don't know. It's beyond me. At another level, I think taking small steps, small awareness of what's happening for me right now in this situation, even as we're speaking now, as it pushes different buttons for each one of us. This is an emotionally charged subject, isn't it? For all of us, to a greater or lesser degree. Some of us might easily survive all this, the fallout from war, But actually finding a place in which we can bear witness. Can I just read you this from Bernie Glassman? And see if it maybe says something. So Bernie Glassman was a successor of Maizumi Roshi and was part of the White Plum Sangha, and also had his own branch, if you like, the Order of Peacemakers.
Peacemaker Order, yeah. So Thomas knows. Thomas has been on Bernie Glassman retreats at Auschwitz. Yeah,
many times.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was going to say. So he is a proponent, clearly, as was Ken Jones, of engaged Buddhism. We don't just sit on our bums on the. And
he started a bakery in New York for people that were.
Yeah.
On the streets.
On the streets, people on the streets, Auschwitz, prisons. So he really took it out there. And that's one thing that we can do. There's nothing restricting any of us to do that sort of stuff. But I think for a lot of us, it's a starting point is what is happening here? What about this? What am I doing with it? It's not to separate it out from bigger conflicts. It's to say, It is there are some elements that are the same. Has, as Thomas was saying before, has peace been abandoned altogether, universally, or is it less reported? Because it's not cool anymore to say, I think there might be some ways of looking at this. So let me read what Bernie Glassman says. As part of the peacemaker order. Are we okay for time?
You're 10 to, so. Okay. Yeah.
I'm going to finish at 1. Or
5 to normally, but 1's good.
Okay,
to
5 to, yeah.
Go.
Quick
piece.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll help you.
Okay. He says, when we bear witness, when we become the situation, homelessness, poverty, illness, violence, death, the right action arises by itself. When we become these things, when we listen deeply, when we are fully present, the right action arises by itself. We don't have to worry what to do. This is pretty radical. Yes. We don't have to figure out solutions ahead of time. It seems a really important message when we're sitting, because we can spend a lot of time. I still do it. Find myself puzzling out how am I going to sort that out, this out, that out next week. How am I going to work out the state of the world and how to respond to it. We don't have to worry what to do. We don't have to figure out solutions ahead of time when we're being fully present. Peacemaking is the functioning of bearing witness. Once we listen with our entire body and mind, loving action will arise. And that's from Bernie Glassman, who's directly involved in those, taking it onto the streets, being real, this is reality. Yeah. But we should never, as Rosh is saying, appreciate that, we should never deny this opportunity we have to do or to be something. Okay. I just wanted to finish really with something as a sort of conclusion, if you like, for me. So I have to say, for me, practice over the years and now, on and off the cushion, means creating and maintaining a peaceful refuge where I can be fully present and bear witness to this life as with all its stories, joys, sorrows, pain, but without judgment, without analysis, without conflict, and without trying to figure it all out. So really just bearing witness to the way it is for me and the way it is for the world, without trying to figure it all out. Also, in seeing the enemy, and we've talked about enemies in different ways, I can understand that whatever I may feel about their leaders, that they, their family, their children, their grandchildren, their ancestors, their friends, all share this great ground of being. Beyond distinction and beyond conflict. Our only responsibility is to realize it. And to realize that we are one. What was the expression from Dogen and Roshi? The one shining pearl.
The one bright pearl, yeah.
The one bright pearl, yeah. Yeah. Whether you like it or not. That's only 5-2, I think. So unless anybody's got anything to add to that, are you? Yeah.
If you want to engage with left, right, east, west, from what position do you take, from what place in yourself are you engaging with those? Right? If you are fire and you want to extinguish fire with fire, I don't think that will work.
Yeah.
So if you are, say, equanimity, equanimous in yourself, then, as you said, the right answer will come.
Yeah. That's what the teaching seems to be.
Manifest.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. One last thing from me. I think it's in this book. Taking Our Hands gives us an example. If you take a rope, you know, you're thinking about the war between the left and the right, the good and the bad, etc. You take a rope, and we'll get rid of the left.
Yeah.
Historically. Yeah. Or we'll get rid of, yeah, we'll chop it off. Trouble is, you've got a new left. And the people just to the left of the right. So we'll chop off the right. But then we've got people who are just sort of more in the centre, but still left and right.
Yes.
So you know, those distinctions will always be there. It's difficult to get rid of them.
Yeah. So basically, if you're peaceful in yourself, you will find a peaceful solution to all the turmoil, doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, yeah. That's our faith. Yeah. If we have faith, that's it. Oh, thanks. Okay.